But could you, the lessons for today for the Black Lives Matter movement and other activists of this COINTELPRO era?
Well, we've just come through a Trump era, and I think we saw the effects of a lack of transparency and accountability. And now we really have to insist that the powers that be are transparent and accountable. And it's up to the average citizen to pay attention, be informed, and be vigilant, and then call the powers that be to account for their decision.
We're going to have to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us. Bonnie Raines, one of the 1971 break-in burglars at the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and Paul Coates, founder and director of Black Classic Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by March 15th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO. Portland, 90.7 FM.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Senate Democrats passed the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill on Saturday without a single Republican vote. The New York Times characterized the bill as, quote, an extraordinary increase in safety net spending in the largest anti-poverty effort in a generation. The bill, called the American Rescue Plan, was buffeted by relentless efforts at amendments before being passed and is different enough from the House version of the bill that it will need to be voted on again in the House. President Joe Biden, who championed the bill and plans to sign it, said at the White House, quote, "Today I can say we've taken one more giant step forward in delivering on the promise that help is on the way. It wasn't always pretty, but it was so desperately needed, urgently needed." Lawmakers are racing to meet the March 14th deadline when existing unemployment benefits expire. West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin held the bill hostage until Senate leaders agreed to cut unemployment benefits to meet his demand. Aside from jobless benefits, people making $75,000 a year or less will begin receiving a stimulus check soon. Additionally, the bill includes funding for states, schools, food stamp programs, and pensions, as well as a significant increase in child tax credits. We'll bring you more detailed coverage of what the bill includes later on our program. Democrats are now eyeing a second massive spending bill on improving American infrastructure. But considering the difficulty of passing the COVID relief bill and the narrow limits of power in the Senate, many are demanding an end to the Senate filibuster rules first. Senator Tina Smith, a Democrat, explained how she has evolved in her thinking from supporting the filibuster to advocating for its end. Writing on her Facebook page, Senator Smith said, quote, "The modern filibuster usually doesn't include any debate at all. What happens is that a senator merely threatens to filibuster, then they go home to dinner. There's no debate and not even any talking, and definitely not any legislating." Even Senator Manchin now says he is open to doing away with the filibuster for certain bills. President Biden on Monday signed an executive order directing his education secretary, Miguel Cardona, to reverse the radical changes that Donald Trump made to Title IX rules, including how college campuses investigate sexual assault. Former education secretary Betsy DeVos changed the rules to protect suspected perpetrators of rape or sexual assault. President Biden signed a second executive order to establish a gender policy council in the White House to mark International Women's Day, and a third one to promote voting rights as a gesture to the 56th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when state troopers violently beat hundreds of civil rights activists in Selma, Alabama. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the declaration of the global COVID-19 pandemic. And to kick off the week, Biden plans to visit a veterans center that is administering vaccines. On Thursday, the president will deliver a primetime speech marking the first year of the pandemic and the 500,000 and rising deaths. Meanwhile, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Monday released guidelines on the activities that those who have been vaccinated can now engage in. In summary, the New York Times explained that fully vaccinated people may visit indoors with unvaccinated people from a single household, so long as no one among the unvaccinated is at risk for severe disease if infected with the coronavirus. They must still continue wearing masks in public, however. At least 60 million Americans have so far received either one or two vaccine doses. The rate of vaccinations last week jumped up 24% from the week before, and a large jump in vaccine availability is expected by April. Dr. Anthony Fauci is even predicting that high school students may be able to get vaccines by the fall. He warned against throwing caution to the wind just yet and slammed the decision by some Republican-led states to reopen their economies as though the pandemic was over. The first state to announce it was reopening, a Mexican restaurant in Texas made news for getting threats of immigration enforcement after it decided to keep its anti-mask policy in place. Anti-mask conservatives in Idaho engaged in a ritual burning of their masks, including children in the bizarre exercise. And in Boulder, Colorado, a mass gathering of young people got out of control on Saturday after hundreds gathered in the streets, most without masks, and overturned a car, provoking a police response. In international news, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and his wife have reportedly contracted COVID-19. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, in a new interview with Axios reporter Jonathan Swan, admitted that the GOP remains under Trump's control and that Trump could make the party bigger or could destroy it.
I just don't get how, after all of that, you go down to Mar-a-Lago and your best pals with
him again. Because he is a dominant force in the Republican Party.
I mean, five people died. I mean, yeah, it's pretty bad.
People had heart attacks, engaged in it, yeah. So here's the thing. My election's over.
Yeah.
I could throw him over tomorrow.
Right.
Why aren't I?
Yeah. That's what I really don't understand.
Okay, well, then you don't understand me very much.
I don't. That's why I'm asking.
That's
you.
Right. There's something about Trump. There's a dark side, and there's some magic there. He could make the Republican Party something that nobody else I know could make it. It could make it bigger. He could make it stronger. He could make it more diverse. And he also could destroy it.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham in an interview with Axios reporter Jonathan Swan. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday rejected the last Trump lawsuit challenging the 2020 election results, putting a legal nail in the coffin of the former president's coup attempts. Jury selection has just begun in the trial of white police officer Derek Chauvin, accused of killing George Floyd in Minneapolis. Chauvin faces charges of second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. On Sunday, thousands of people gathered outside the Hennepin County Government Center and marched silently as they carried a white wooden coffin to symbolize Floyd's death and the massive anti-police brutality movement that it sparked across the nation. The trial is expected to be the biggest in Minneapolis history and 3,000 National Guardsmen have been activated to prepare for the inevitable public anger. In Rochester, New York, where the killers of another black man named Daniel Prude went free, police were caught on video pepper spraying a black woman in the face in view of her 3-year-old child last month. Police accused her of shoplifting but found nothing. They then pursued and arrested her simply because she ran away. A new study of youth detention centers in the U.S. finds shockingly high racial discrimination. The Annie E. Casey Foundation surveyed juvenile justice centers in 30 states around the U.S. during the course of the coronavirus pandemic and found that white youth were significantly more likely to be released from detention than black youth. Additionally, the study found that more people of color are being detained for longer sentences than they were before the pandemic hit. In international news, the U.S. has proposed an interim power-sharing agreement between the Taliban in Afghanistan and the U.S.-backed Afghan government. The Biden administration's proposal, in the form of a letter from State Secretary Antony Blinken, comes just months ahead of a May 1st deadline to withdraw U.S. troops from the longest official war in modern American history. Violence from the Taliban and other militant groups has increased over the past year. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's government did not respond well to the Blinken letter. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Senate on Saturday passed, by a 50-50 vote and Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote, the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill backed by President Joe Biden. After weeks of wrangling over the details of the American Rescue Plan, including a battle to include an increase to the federal minimum wage that ultimately failed, the bill did pass and now heads to the House for a Tuesday vote. While many are hailing it as the largest expansion of government anti-poverty efforts in a generation, progressives feel the bill did not go far enough, considering the nation's crippling inequality. My guest is Joe Dinkin, Working Families Party National Communications Director. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thanks again for having me, Sonali. I'm happy to be here.
So let's first talk about the battle over the $15 an hour minimum wage, which seems to be a symbol of what Democrats are willing to do, how they could fail, you know, in a way that sort of implies that they themselves haven't been able to go far enough. Was that battle, which ultimately failed, to you a troubling indication of the party's future?
I think it is troubling. I want to say a couple of things about the relief bill passed in the Senate this past weekend. In some measure, it is pretty remarkable as a success in how progressives have changed the window of the possible. The Senate managed to pass a $1.9 trillion bill that puts money in the pockets of working people through cash relief, through childcare, through a number of other important measures, state and local funding, and without any kind of the major giveaways to corporations or tax cuts that you often see in these big packages. And so in some measure, it's really a remarkable achievement that a $1.9 trillion package really dedicated wholly to things that benefit working class and middle class people. On the other hand, there are some troubling signs in the politics of what happened. And, you know, with Democrats in power, Democrats are accountable to lead and the people expect them to lead. And so when popular measures get excluded or cut, it tells voters sometimes that, that Democrats don't have the ability or the willingness to do those things. And I think the $15 minimum wage is a perfect example. It's not the only example, too. Democrats ended up negotiating with themselves over cutting the expanded unemployment that was in the original version of the bill. It was going to be an added $400 a week continuing on extended unemployment benefits, and the timeline got shrank and it got restricted from an additional $400 to an additional $300. The minimum wage, the $15 minimum wage, an overwhelmingly popular policy, including popular in purple, red, and blue states alike, was cut out of the final package. And there was this ongoing dispute over whether or not to further restrict the cash relief. And the cash relief was further restricted slightly, got about 12 million people who might have gotten checks during the last relief package cut out of it. And all told, I think there are many valuable things that are passed out of this bill and relief that people need. But when we look at the scale of crisis that voters have lived through over the last 2 years, Democrats are going to need to do a lot more, and they're going to need to figure out how to pass things with 50 votes rather than, you know, a reconciliation package like this bill was done can pass with 50 votes, but by simultaneously saying that minimum wage is not subject to reconciliation, but rather needs 60 votes, and that reforming the filibuster is essentially not on the table. It really like puts for me the onus on leaders in both chambers and in the White House to tell us how they're not why they can't pass a $15 minimum wage, but how they're going to deliver it. Right. And with Democrats holding both chambers, if they don't manage to do so, voters will have nobody to blame for that. But Democrats being unable to get it together to do so. So for the sake of the many, many millions of working class families that desperately need an increase in the minimum wage that hasn't risen and more than a decade, I really hope that they can figure it out.
Let's talk about, and I want to get to the filibuster, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and all of these folks, but let's talk about what is in the bill. Because if you read the corporate media, this is the greatest anti-poverty program in a generation. It's the biggest expansion. It's an anti-austerity measures. Many have hailed the child tax credits that have passed. Even though the unemployment, weekly unemployment benefits were reduced from, I believe it was $400 to $300 a week, which is nearly not enough. And even though the $15 an hour raise was not included, what was included in that progressives should hail as important?
Yeah, I think the cash relief going out to the overwhelming majority of Americans is a big deal.
These were the stimulus checks that the eligibility was also narrowed. That was another issue.
Should have been or should be recurring for on the scale of how long people have been in crisis, but their passage still is a lot of money in the pockets of working class and middle class families. I think that the child tax credit that people talk about, the expanded child credit, is a kind of under-noticed provision that will in fact put lots of money in the pockets of working class and middle class families with kids. And while it's temporary right now, expansions of benefits like that are sometimes hard to claw back after they're created. And so we think there is a chance that they could be extended. The ongoing unemployment is sort of a partway win. It wasn't expanded the way that we wanted, but at the same time, the added unemployment benefits continue forward in a way that, you know, had we not won in Georgia, Democrats probably would not have been able to, if Democrats hadn't won control of the Senate, we would have ended up with Republicans probably blocking the extended unemployment insurance much more severely. And then the funding for state and local aid is going to be a huge relief to municipalities that are seeing the specter of budget cuts at the local and state level. You know, the municipalities and states don't have the ability to borrow the same way that the federal government does. And so preventing state governments from ending up cutting school, you know, funding for education, funding for healthcare, you know, public employees' pensions during this crisis, I think is a relief. That said, like you said, there's also some major items that
I want to just focus on the child tax credit for a minute, because I don't know if it's gotten enough attention. In one New York Times article about it, it says, though framed in technocratic terms as an expansion of an existing tax credit, it is essentially a guaranteed income for families with children, akin to children's allowances that are common in other rich countries. And then Lisa Featherstone, writing in Jacobin magazine about the entire child tax credits part of the bill, also explained that this is notable because the child tax credit expansion is something that has happened for the first time in the 24-year history of the credit. The money is going to be offered even to people with no taxable income, which is quite significant. And as you said, it's the kind of thing that once it is in place, it becomes easier to extend it, which Democrats don't often enough take advantage of. So this seems to be a very significant thing for families with children, at least.
I think that's right. And what's so interesting to observe is how much a rising progressive movement has succeeded in changing the arguments at the heart of Democratic Party politics. You know, it wasn't that long ago, you know, 20 something years ago, that Bill Clinton was, you know, declaring the end of welfare as we know it. This is with no strings or work requirements attached in sort of old neoliberal democratic model. This is cat in the hands of poor and working class and middle class families to help cover the high cost of raising children. And it's you know, guaranteed as of right. It's not, as you say, it's guaranteed whether or not you owe taxes. So in the same way that the earned income tax credit is a, you know, revenue positive, and it's actually people are going to experience it as, you know, cash that they receive directly rather than showing up in a complicated formula on their taxes.
Hmm. So that is pretty significant. And it's interesting because, at least as a journalist covering this bill before it passed, it wasn't an issue that was very focused on, and maybe it benefited from the lack of focus by being included in this massive bill and getting passed, because often a lot of these battles turn into culture wars. Let's talk about the opposition that the minimum wage increase received from seven Democrats and one independent who caucuses with Democrats. I mean, obviously, we expected all 50 Republicans to oppose it, but for so many Democrats and Angus King to oppose this is an indication of the challenge for other issues to come when addressing inequality, right? I mean, Kyrsten Sinema, who is such an interesting case in point, there was an interesting piece by David Sirota about her that pointed out that she was once a leader in the Green Party. She was so progressive that she was known as an icon in a third party. And now her famous thumbs down for the minimum wage raise has earned her the ire of progressives. Why are these Democrats literally voting against their own party's interests? I mean, Biden won Arizona, Kyrsten Sinema's state.
Sure. I think it's a really good question. And it just goes to show that there's more organizing that needs to be done, and that, you know, politicians are not permanent friends or permanent enemies. They're the targets that we have to move the people behind them, or move the people to move the politicians. And so, you know, there are big organizing efforts underway in all of those states so that the senators hear from and feel accountable to the voters that so desperately need a minimum wage increase. I think it is really also a challenge that's going to require the leaders of the Democratic Party, who have committed to this goal of a $15 minimum wage, to exert muscle to help bring the entire caucus along.
Let's also now talk about the issue of the filibuster. Senator Tina Smith, who's a Democrat, in a lengthy Facebook post explained how she started as a supporter of this tactic because, you know, in theory, the filibuster is meant to, or we think of it in idealistic terms as something that encourages debate, encourages two parties to come to a consensus by requiring 60 votes, and that an actual filibuster is in the takes the form of senators having endless discussions. But in fact, all that ends up happening, according to Senator Tina Smith, who has now evolved on this issue, is that they threaten the filibuster and then go home to dinner. And one party can simply hold the other party hostage. She has evolved on the filibuster. And now we're hearing that Joe Manchin might consider exempting certain bills from being held hostage to the filibuster. But I mean, he is the one, right, who's holding, these Democratic Party bread and butter issues hostage.
You know, I think you have to start with an understanding that the Senate itself is an anti-democratic institution. Mm-hmm. It biases small states, rural states, and overwhelmingly white states. It's just worth noting that even though the Senate is deadlocked at 50-50, the Democratic caucus in the Senate represents 40 million more people than the Republican caucus in the Senate. So even just having to win Democrats based on the current coalitions that make up the two big parties, even just having to win a majority requires for Democrats a much broader level of public support, popular support, winning over more of the voters in America than it does for Republicans. Adding the 60 vote threshold on top of it makes a lot of different kinds of legislation almost totally off the table. And I think that's an unacceptable option, whether what you care about is climate change or voting rights or the minimum wage. It's just unacceptable to say that we can never do those things until there are 60 Senate votes, because 60 Senate votes is not just requiring a supermajority, it's requiring an overwhelming supermajority of voters in the country to be electing just to get to 60 Democrats. Frankly, I think that the Senate as a whole is a huge constraint on the ability of progressives to pass policy. Understanding that, we actually have a very narrow window to, you know, solve the massive crises that people expect us to solve. And with Democrats in power, we think it's imperative that they do so.
Right. You're talking about the 2022 midterms, where, you know, traditionally the party in power, especially one that controls all three branches of government, will lose some power in the midterms that follow. Democrats cannot afford to lose even a single Senate seat, and certainly no more than a handful of House seats. You write in a piece that you just authored about the fight over the COVID relief bill that the choice for Democrats in Congress is to go big or go home. Now, let's take Senator Joe Manchin. He's a representative of West Virginia. And the assumption is that he votes the way he does. He basically votes like a Republican. I mean, the only benefit he really offers the Democratic Party is that they get to have committee chairs and majorities on committees. But the assumption is that he would lose re-election in West Virginia if he supported some of these progressive Democratic Party proposals. But is that really true, especially of issues that involve lifting America's poor up?
Look, our polling found 63% of West Virginia voters supporting a $15 minimum wage.
Wow.
It's a popular a popular idea all across America. I mean, if you look at Florida in the 2020 elections, Joe Biden lost Florida by a couple of points on the same day, on the same ballot, an amendment to raise the state minimum wage in Florida to the $15 an hour passed with 60% of the vote. So we know that raising the minimum wage is popular among voters. But I think that the idea that Republicans are going to come to the table to negotiate is a fantasy and belies everything that we've learned over the last 8 years or over the last 12 years or more. It is in the interest of the Republicans to have the economy still be pretty bad for most working people in 2022. That will allow them to say to American voters, you put Democrats in charge, are things getting better for you? And if the answer isn't absolutely clear, that's what creates the familiar pattern of the party in power losing seats in the midterm. I think the way for Democrats to overcome and avoid that is Democrats have to go big. If Democrats go big, imagine a world in 2022 where unemployment has dropped to a tiny number, where COVID is nothing but a terrible memory, where wages are going up, where millions of jobs are being created in care and in transforming our climate, and where voters know that it's the Democrats that did that, I think that's the situation in which Democrats have the best chance to overcome the normal political gravity of the midterm reaction. If voters know that it's their basic economic security is getting better, and it's the Democrats who did that for them. But that's the responsibility of the Democrats to go big, because Republicans will profit if they manage to stall action on important provisions.
So if Joe Manchin refuses to do the right thing, even when it, you know, is popular in his own state, is the step then for progressives to primary these Senate Democrats and honestly, even any House Democrats that are not willing to go far enough to back popular measures that help struggling Americans? We've seen in the House that has been a fairly good strategy. We saw that a populist left, the populist left ideas helped Georgia Senators Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff win their races in this past January. Is it time to start talking about primarying these Senate Democrats?
I think in the immediate, the most important thing is for those senators to hear from voters in their own states about what life is really like having come through the catastrophic year of 2020. We need to have voters en masse telling their own stories of the lives they've lived, you know, struggling through some of the hardest times a lot of people have ever struggled through without, you know, in our country in generations, often, you know, losing jobs, losing income, losing their homes. And I think those senators need to hear directly from their voters, and they need to listen to them. To me, that's the most important.
Do you think that the next bill that Democrats are eyeing, which of course, given the difficulty of passing this COVID relief bill, will make the next one more difficult, but that one focuses on, at least right now, what we're hearing is that Democrats are interested in passing a large infrastructure bill. And of course, we still have the For the People Act, which is the massive overhaul of a federal overhaul of voting rights, which is really important to help hold on to power in the next round of elections, because we know Republicans play dirty and essentially win through undemocratic means. But in the infrastructure bill, there's now talk of, you know, senators like Bernie Sanders backing recurring payments to Americans until the pandemic is over, while of course, at the same time being an important jobs program to help improve our crumbling infrastructure. Is that a good focus for the left going forward?
Yeah, I think that the jobs and recovery package is a hugely important opportunity for the left to engage on. You know, we at the Working Families Party are supporting a vision called the Thrive Agenda, which would invest $1 trillion in every year for the next 10 years in creating and maintaining 16 million new jobs, primarily in transitioning our energy sector to clean energy, in care jobs, in, you know, addressing the shortage in nursing care and child care and elder care that we need, and in which are also, by the way, clean climate jobs, jobs that are really needed and also don't have a big carbon footprint, and also investing in repair for the frontline communities, mainly communities of color, that have suffered the worst impacts of current dirty energy economy through problems like asthma and other forms of environmental pollution in their neighborhoods. So we think there's an opportunity to go very big and very ambitious, and it is our hope that Democrats take up that opportunity, and they'll be hearing from us about that right now.
And I imagine that too is the kind of thing that is very likely popular with Americans. I mean, we just saw the Texas energy grid fail in the extreme winter weather. Americans largely now agree that climate change is real. They need jobs. It seems a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think it's an overwhelmingly popular proposal. And for us, the task will be to be mobilized enough that we create the inevitability that's the plan for Democrats to take up.
And then finally, the House on Tuesday is expected to vote on the bill. They already passed a version of the bill, but the version that they passed included the minimum wage increase And I imagine that the Senate version of the bill that passed on Saturday is different enough from the House version that they have to pass it separately again, and then it is expected to be signed into law by Joe Biden. Do you think that Biden, in his, you know, because one of the problems that Democrats often have is they don't sell their party very well to voters. They don't sell their achievements very well to voters. And I think part of that is that they're constantly trying to toe a line between pleasing Wall Street and pleasing their base. But if they literally chose to please their base and shouted it from the mountaintops that this was an achievement, modest as it was, it could have a big impact on popular perception and therefore the party and the nation's future, right?
Yeah, I think absolutely Democrats should do everything they can to take a victory lap on the $1.9 trillion plan, but also to tell us where it's going from here, and to show the scope of their ambition, show accomplishment, and generate some momentum for continuing to win the kind of policies that will really lift up working class people and help us recover from this year of crisis in 2020.
And by the way, just to mention the Republicans in the Senate, Roy Blunt of Missouri just announced that he would not be running for re-election. He becomes a fifth senator, including Richard Burr and Pat Toomey, Rob Portman and Richard Shelby, to announce their retirement. There was an interesting interview that Lindsey Graham did, of course, top-ranking senator, with Axios reporter Jonathan Swan, where he all but said that the party was being held hostage by Donald Trump. And it seems as though Republicans are saying, rather than choose the pariah status of Mitt Romney and speaking out against Trump, they're either going along with Trump, even if they disagree with him, like Graham, or simply retiring. But these do represent openings for the Democratic Party in the Senate, right?
I think they do. And I think it speaks to how badly broken our two-party system is, that one party can be held so totally captive to a white nationalist base like that. I think that that's really a shameful event in our nation. And I do think that the retirement of Senate Republicans shows that the normal partisan trajectory of a bounce back in the midterms towards Republicans is not inevitable. I think Republicans also think it's not inevitable, but I think that for Democrats to realize that opportunity, they've got to lead with ambition and vision. They've got to win on things like the relief package, which they just did. But even after the $1,400 checks dry up, they're going to need to be explaining how they're going to recover from a year of historic crisis from not just COVID, but also the economic recession caused by it that's left many families in much more precarious financial situation than they were before, how to deal with the growing and undeniable crisis around climate change, how to tackle racial justice. And I think if Democrats put forward that vision, there is an opportunity for them to continue to gain ground if they go big.
Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for Working Families Party.
Yeah, please join Working Families at www.workingfamilies.org, or just text member to 30403. And get connected up with us that way. You can just text member to 30403.
Thank you so much, Joe, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. Always happy to be here.
My guest, Joe Dinkin, is with Working Families Party, and we've been discussing the COVID relief bill that the Senate just passed. The House will vote on and likely pass that bill on Tuesday, after which it is expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A new study based in Stockton, California, of a guaranteed basic income found that over the course of 2 years, the study's participants benefited significantly from having a no-strings-attached monthly stipend of $500. Participants who were unemployed found jobs at twice the rate of non-participants, and they experienced better mental health and overall well-being. The study's results are particularly well-timed given how the coronavirus pandemic has greatly deepened existing income and wealth inequality in the United States. My guest is Suki Samra, director of SEED, the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, which is the nation's first mayor-led guaranteed income demonstration. Welcome to the program, Suki.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about what a guaranteed income actually means. I think a lot of people have heard about a universal basic income, or UBI, and particularly a result of presidential candidate Andrew Yang of New York. But this isn't exactly that, although some might say it's related. What exactly is a guaranteed income of the kind that your study looked at?
Yeah, a guaranteed income is a direct cash payment that's given directly to individuals with no strings attached and no work requirements. You're right in that it's oftentimes conflated with a UBI, and the concepts are actually, they are really similar in that they're both no strings attached, it's unconditional payments. Where guaranteed income differs is that it's targeted. So it's not going to everyone like UBI is, but it's usually targeted along income lines, so that it's going towards people most in need, and it's more often touted as a tool for equity, especially racial and gender equity. And just noting sort of the history of guaranteed income itself, as you mentioned, UBI guaranteed income gained a lot of popularity because of Andrew Yang's presidential campaign, but the idea itself actually has a long history. We like to say that it's as old as the nation itself. And most notably for us, it's really important to root it in the racial justice and social justice movements of the 1960s, when you had Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the National Welfare Rights Organization, and the Black Panthers all advocating for a guaranteed income as the simplest and most effective way to abolish poverty.
Let's talk about the study itself. I understand it was 24 months long. How many participants were there, and how were they picked?
Sure. So SEED ran for 24 months, as you mentioned. It was 125 randomly selected Stocktonians getting $500 per month, unconditional, again, no work requirements. Folks were selected at random from neighborhoods in Stockton that were at or below the city's median household income of about $46,000. We chose a very randomized approach because we were the first study, the first mayor-led study, and so we wanted to make sure that we were running a full RCT and that our results were really going to be applicable to studies that popped up elsewhere.
And why is Stockton an interesting place to conduct a study like this? What is unique about this city?
There's a lot. So the first thing that we say is that Stockton really is an all-American city. I think 2 years ago, it was named the nation's most diverse city. About a third of our population is foreign-born. Folks speak more than one language in their households. We have a rich ethnic history. The first and oldest Sikh temple in North America at one point had the largest Filipino population outside of the Philippines. And so we really believe that if a guaranteed income can work in Stockton, it can work anywhere, because Stockton's story is the American story. And the second thing is that historically, Stockton was a city that people ran from rather than to. We at one point had higher per capita homicide rates than Chicago. We were the first city before Detroit to declare bankruptcy, really hit hard by the 2008-2009 recession. And we're still reeling from the effects of it today, compounded, of course, by COVID. But when we launched SEED, nearly one in four households was experiencing poverty. We had we were 18th in the nation for child poverty. And so we really saw guaranteed income in Stockton as a way to see how a guaranteed income, its simple yet very effective solution, could work.
Already, of course, we have seen pre-pandemic racial differences, systemic racial differences in wealth and income and education access and job access and salary along racial lines and gender lines as well, but very dramatically along racial lines. That got worse during the pandemic. In fact, even the recovery from the pandemic that is just now starting, we're seeing the biggest gains among white workers and Black workers being left behind. So how did this study examine or what would you be able to sort of discover about the pandemic and what such a program can do to address income inequality, especially along racial lines in an emergency like the pandemic?
Sure. So the data that we released is actually only from the first year of the experiment. So it's from February 2019 to February 2020. So it's right before the pandemic hit. And we like to say that we got really lucky because we're actually doing two experiments within one, and that the second year of data will be entirely able to answer the question that you're asking. How exactly can a guaranteed income act as a financial vaccine? Well, we don't necessarily have employment statistics or any of the health and well-being outcomes that we have for the first year. We do know anecdotally that recipients who are receiving the $500 a month were able to leverage it to actually heed public health warnings. We saw folks being able to stockpile food in the same way that people who are more economically secure were doing. So people were able to go to Costco and really bulk purchase. I also heard from recipients that they were able to leverage the guaranteed income while they waited insurance to kick in. We remember a year ago, there were so many news stories about how the unemployment insurance system was just so overloaded and that folks were waiting a really, really long time for assistance to kick in. And so we heard from a couple of recipients that they were able to leverage the $500 a month to just stay stable while they were waiting for their other benefits to kick in. So again, we don't have the full data yet, but we've heard from recipients that they were in a much better place going into the pandemic than those who didn't receive the money.
So you have anecdotal evidence to that effect. Let's talk about the actual measurable outcomes after the first year, specifically on the issue of those who had difficulty finding a job, being able to find a job. I mean, often when we hear conservatives who want to talk about poverty or want to attack any kind of government welfare program, they feel that assistance is antithetical to or detriment to or disincentive to people working. Oh, if you give people free money, they're less likely to go out and look for a job. It seems as though your study found the opposite.
Yeah, that's simply not the case. To your point, when we first started to see the number one criticism that we got, well, there was two. One was that if you give people money, they're going to spend it on drugs and alcohol.
Of course, is a very racist viewpoint.
Exactly, racist, and our data also doesn't pan out in that way. And then the second piece of feedback or criticism that we got was that if you give people money, they're going to stop working. Again, really rooted in these racist and sexist tropes that people are lazy by their own choices, people are lazy because they don't work hard, people are lazy because they have some sort of moral shortcoming. And we found the opposite. We found that people who received the guaranteed income were able to transition from part-time to full-time employment at more than twice the rate of those who didn't. At the beginning of the demonstration in February 2019, those who were receiving the $500 a month, only 28% were employed full-time. A year later, 40% of those who were receiving the $500 per month were employed full-time. And so we see a 12 percentage point difference. And it comes down to the fact that once people had the $500 a month, once they had an income floor, and they knew that they could pay the bills, they could pay for their phone bills, they could pay for their electricity bills, they're really able to just calm down, just to breathe for a second, and to be able to really imagine a new future for themselves and take opportunities on themselves. We heard about people finally being able to go for a job interview, not because they were lazy before, but because they were wage workers who just could not afford to lose one shift to go interview for something else, because it meant that they would have to cut something out of their household budget for that month. Hmm. And so that we see that the $500 a month really just allowed people the ability to take risks on themselves in a way that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
Wow, I imagine that parents might have been able to pay for childcare to go for an interview because of that extra income or any of these extra things. We know that in this country, in order to make money, you have to have money, which is why the rich end up getting richer. Not that $500 a month is by any means rich, but for the poorest of the poor, it can make a huge difference. Just a small amount of money. So this was an experiment that I understand then led to Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. Tell me about this sort of new formation that came out of SEED.
Sure. So as you said, SEED was intended to be a 24-month demonstration to provide sort of proof of concept for this idea of a guaranteed income. And we've In June 2020, we launched Mayors for a Guaranteed Income to really scale the idea. And we founded it for a number of reasons. One was, as you've mentioned several times, COVID-19 really highlighted the ways in which our systems fail, and they fail particularly for folks of color, for Black people, for Black women. And second, we knew that mayors were stepping up in response to COVID-19, especially at a time when the federal administration, the previous administration, just wasn't and wasn't even acknowledging the science around the pandemic. The second reason that we really wanted to leverage mayors and sort of launch Mayors for a Guaranteed Income was this: we launched right in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and we wanted to be sure to really tie the conversations around racial justice and economic justice together and recognize that there is no racial justice without economic justice and vice versa. So we launched Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, a coalition of what started as 11 mayors and is now 42 mayors who are advocating for a federal guaranteed income through activities like policy advocacy and making sure that we have cash checks coming out in any stimulus package, through activities like narrative change work, like documentaries, really trying to disrupt the way that Americans think about poverty, and through running pilots of their own. So through the coalition, we'll have about 12 to 15 more pilots emerge that draw from the lessons of SEED, that are a little bit more targeted in their approach, or as just as wide, using different types of funding sources. But the goal really being to move from pilots to policy, because in the long term, this is really a policy that has to be sustained at the federal level.
And tell me about the vision of former Mayor Michael Tubbs, who I understand formed the basis, or at least was a starting point for this experiment.
Sure. So in terms of his vision, I think it was, as I mentioned, just to test a really effective and simple solution to poverty. Poverty is abhorrent. It shouldn't exist in the richest country in the world. And we have the resources to stop it. We know that poverty is so costly to our systems in the long term, and the lost potential of kids in emergency room visits, et cetera. So instead of our policies being reactive, why not make them proactive and make sure that folks aren't experiencing economic insecurity in the first place? So that was his vision behind launching SEED in Stockton and now scaling it through MGI to again prove that COVID-19 again has illustrated that our social safety net just does not work, particularly for the most vulnerable. And so this is our moment to reimagine it, and we have to include an income floor as part of that.
So the experiment that was conducted essentially gave $500 per month over the course of 24 months. That's only $12,000 per person or household, I imagine. And that, for the purposes of the experiment, came from private funders. But if a pilot program like this were to be expanded into, say, even a citywide initiative, because your study only had 125 participants, and obviously Stockton is a lot bigger than that, where would the money come from for this? And how would you make the case? Because, of course, you know the naysayers are going to make that as their first question. How do we pay for it?
Yeah, and I think what we say, budgets are moral documents, and this isn't a question of how do we pay for it as much as are we willing to pay for this. I think there's a number of ways that we can pay for it. The former presidential candidate Andrew Yang proposed a value-added tax. We could do a wealth tax. We've seen folks in cities playing around with using cannabis revenue.
And actually, Senator Elizabeth Warren has just introduced what she calls the ultra millionaires wealth tax, which would just affect something like 600 plus people in the entire country and wouldn't even touch the first $50 million of wealth of anybody and would generate quite a bit of revenue. I mean, that would obviously be a nationwide thing, and I haven't done the math to think about whether that would actually fund something like this nationwide. But this isn't, as you said, since it's a guaranteed minimum income, it isn't something that would be universal. It would be targeted. So it could potentially be something that could be afforded by the government.
Exactly. And we actually saw a similar model of this. And then Senator Harris actually proposed the LIFT Act, which would have given effectively $500 a month to families making about $125,000 and less. And that was paid for through a reversal of the Trump tax cuts.
So this is Kamala Harris, who isn't really known for her radical progressive ideals, but that's impressive.
Exactly. So this is exactly when she was a senator. And so we've seen there are plenty of ways that we can pay for this. Other cities that that are in the network and sort of conversations we've heard are, as we're talking about defunding the police and reimagining our public safety, our social our sort of public safety net, how do we redistribute those funds in a way that is equitable? So there's a, again, there's a lot of ways in which this can be paid for. It's just about matching the will with it.
We talked about the fact that participants in your study had twice the success, or were able to find jobs at twice the rate of non-participants. But I feel like often an undervalued aspect is mental health and well-being, the kind of anxiety that is associated with living on the edge of precarity. Financial precarity has deep impacts on overall health. What were the health impacts of this guaranteed minimum income?
Sure. So as you said, we know that poverty creeps under the skin, that it's not just something that you're struggling with externally, but that it leads to anxiety and depression, that it activates the fight or flight response, and that switch just never turns off. And so what we saw was that at the beginning of the demonstration, almost everyone, both in our treatment group and our control group, classified as sort of clinically depressed and anxious. So wow. If they were going to the doctor and be presented the scales that we use, the CASR-10 and the SF-36, and they answered all those questions, their doctors would have said, you're struggling with anxiety or depression. By the end, or a year into the demonstration, the recipients were less anxious and less depressed, both over time and compared to the control group, and were more likely to be quote unquote healthy on those scales. So we saw people with statistically significant improvements in emotional health, energy over fatigue, emotional well-being, as well as physical pain. So again, just really seeing the ways in which, one, poverty creeps under the skin and has really visceral impacts, but two, the ways in which $500 a month can be as effective as other forms of medication. Not to say medication isn't important, but that it can, just giving people cash can serve as an antidote to so much of this sort of physical and emotional well-being questions that we face.
I mean, I'm just imagining if somebody offered to give me $500 or whatever dollars a month, I can imagine my anxiety being greatly relieved. And I don't even live on the edge of poverty as many of the study's recipients do. There's also a similar case one could make, I imagine, for a program like Medicare for All, if one didn't have to worry about, say, accessing healthcare. What a relief it would be for those people who live in the nation currently without access to health insurance, et cetera. So it's very, very, it seems to make sense if you really stop and think about it. Tell me about the participants from the study, some of whom you profile on your website, just so we can put some human faces and names to the study and its impact.
Sure. One of the recipients that has been featured on our website as well, some of the media interviews, is a man named Tomas Vargas Jr. He was a Stockton all his life, lived in North Stockton with his wife and two kids. And he, when he started Seed, was working part-time at a distribution center and then was also on top of that, just hustling to make ends meet, taking every single job that he could. And he talks about how before Seed started, he never had a chance to spend time with his children. He was never home. He dreaded waking up every morning. And he just had to pull himself out of bed with so much anxiety and so much stress because he was always worried about where the next dollar was going to come from and how he was going to keep a roof over his head and his kids' heads. Fast forward, he gets the $500 per month, and he's able to not only leverage it to gain full-time employment, he's actually able to switch industries completely and now serves as a case manager at a local nonprofit in town, getting a full-time job with benefits. But he also talks, again, just about being able to spend time with his children finally and getting to know them for who they are. He talks about how his daughter loves the word banana, just throws the word banana around like it's a cuss word or something and just says it all the time and starts laughing. He talks about how his son wants to be the mayor and then he wants to be the president and just all these aspirations that his children have that he didn't know about before. And so it's just about, again, it's that dignity that everyone deserves, but folks who are experiencing economic insecurity aren't afforded, of being able to be the parent that you want to be and being able to show up for your kids.
Which has an impact on the next generation. I mean, you know, setting aside mental health issues for the person who's actually the recipient, I imagine that the mental health of their children is greatly improved. They get to spend more time with their parents.
We know that poverty is intergenerational. And so as we're providing these folks these pathways to mobility and allowing them to spend more time at home with their kids, we're really going to see, I think, the intergenerational impacts of how you can give folks $500 a month and really allow them to access their full potential.
give out a website for SEED and also the mayors for guaranteed minimum income that people can find out more about the work, maybe consider doing an experiment in their own city, or even simply take the results of your pilot and start pushing for it to be implemented?
Sure. So the website for SEED is StocktonDemonstration.org, and the website for Mayors for Guaranteed Income is MayorsforAGI.org.
That's MayorsforAGI.org and StocktonDemonstration.org. I want to thank you so much, Suki, for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Of course. Thank you.
My guest has been Suki Samra, Director of SEED, which stands for the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, the nation's first mayor-led guaranteed income demonstration. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters, RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
From Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Are you a KBOO member? Tell us why you support KBOO.